Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. After a judge or jury finds a defendant guilty, a judge typically decides the sentence. Now judges across the country are turning to artificial intelligence for help. And skeptics worry that the algorithms behind the AI could be discriminatory. Karen Ho covers artificial intelligence for MIT Technology Review. She recently wrote about AI and sentencing. She joins us by Skype. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Anne.
Did I pronounce your name correctly?
You did. Okay. Yes.
How common is the use of AI in criminal sentencing at this point?
It's actually really hard to quantify because a lot of these systems are completely proprietary and there's not a lot of transparency in whether or not jurisdictions adopt the systems. But it is safe to say that it's pretty prevalent and there are many, many defendants every year in the U.S. that are being put through these algorithms.
You mean a public entity like a court, an officer of the court, a judge can have a contract with one of these operations and they don't have to reveal that?
They might reveal it in public documents, but they might not actually announce it. And so because a lot of people don't actually even understand that these systems are being used, no one's actually looking for them. And so it can be really tough to understand whether they're using it, the extent to which they're using it, how much the algorithms are actually influencing their decisions. And of course, the algorithms themselves, there's no way to actually evaluate whether or not the algorithms themselves, what exactly they're doing, because the code is proprietary.
Can you walk us through how a judge might use AI to decide something?
Sure. So one of the most common systems in use is called Compass. And ProPublica did an investigation in 2016 that kind of revealed how pervasive it was in use. And the way that Compass recommends judges use their system is it first will train their system on historical data of defendants based on a variety of factors like age, when they committed the crime, what the crime was, when they committed what they were accused for, mm-hmm. and other things, but not race. That is specifically illegal, so it does not consider the defendant's race. And then it will apply the historical trends of what it sees in that jurisdiction onto future defendants. So a judge might run a defendant through a system, see what the risk score is, and the system will give a risk score, Compass will give a risk score between 1 and 10. And it's supposed to roughly correlate with how likely the system believes that the defendant might commit a crime again. So a 1 is a roughly 10% chance. A 10 is like almost guaranteed that they would likely commit a crime again. And the judge is then supposed to use that to, as part of the other considerations they have, to then inform their decision-making process. The problem is that this happens during pretrial. So this is before the defendant has even had any due process.
Really?
And the second, yes. What they're actually doing is they're trying to decide whether or not to jail a defendant before they've even been given due process because of a fear that if they let the defendant roam free before their court date, they might bring harm to society again. So that's the first problem. And the second problem is we don't actually have data on crimes. We have data on arrests. And arrests are not the same thing as crimes, especially in the U.S. where there's a very long history of racism in the way that arrests are made.
Right.
And so that's another huge problem is that these systems are being run on something completely discriminatory already.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about how artificial intelligence is being used by judge to decide, as my guest said, pre-trial, whether or not to jail somebody before their trial begins. My guest is Karen Ho. She's artificial intelligence reporter for MIT Technology Review. A couple things jump out at me. You said in that they apply the history trends in that jurisdiction. Isn't that inherently racist because some jurisdictions historically have more, say, African Americans in that jurisdiction than in another?
Yeah, that is absolutely right. You're hitting the nail on the head. There was a very extensive legal review that was conducted by the AI Now Institute earlier this year, where they found that there is a very long history of police jurisdictions not just having racist practices, but also having corruption in the way that they document their practices. So in New York City, for example, there have been instances investigated by the DOD where the police have falsified data to try and meet certain metrics to look better in the public eye. And so it will document arrests that never occurred or make defendants look like they committed a crime that they never did. And most often, it disproportionately affects Black defendants.
And as long as we're looking historically in order to educate the AI, that's going to be inculcated into it.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the biggest problems with artificial intelligence systems is it kind of repeats history. And sometimes you don't want to do that. You want to actually be moving society forward. But if you're only ever training the artificial intelligence on historical patterns, that's all it's ever going to understand.
This also, and I've raised this before in other shows, but it is making me think about Minority Report, the movie, and, you know, the pre-crime bureau, and how the idea whether someone's likely to commit a crime again or not, is that part of a judge's decision when they decide whether to not jail or whether to set bond or bail or whatever it is?
Yeah, it's a huge part of the decision. Because, I mean, to be fair to judges, like there's huge pressure on the criminal legal system in the U.S. Because there are very few resources. It's expensive to keep a defendant in jail, but it's also potentially harmful to release a defendant in jail. So their judges are put in a tough position. And fundamentally, what they're trying to do is trying their best to fairly allocate resources and fairly essentially shuffle these defendants through a system in a way that protects society. But the fact that they are using these systems is kind of, they shoot themselves in their own foot because these systems aren't necessarily equipped all the time to make these correct decisions. And because they are proprietary, it kind of really puts a huge wrench into the whole transparent due process of the way that the U.S. criminal legal system is supposed to be built upon. So it's a really tough problem right now.
Is that the only way, because it focuses on jurisdictions and also data on arrests, which tend to be skewed unfairly against people of color? Are there other ways that AI can be biased? Because we've talked about in the show before about like face identification things and that kind of a thing, mm-hmm. and that so many of the programmers are white males that are doing the programming, mm-hmm. and that is there again. Therein lies another inherent bias: is that humans are programming them.
Yeah, specifically in the criminal legal system, there are other points in the pipeline where algorithms are also being used. So predictive policing algorithms, for example, are being used in many police departments to figure out where they should be placing their police officers to police neighborhoods. Those are also being trained on historical data. These police officers are being sent to neighborhoods that historically had more rearrests. But the problem is now all of these police officers are in usually predominantly poor, predominantly minority communities, and they're not in other places like predominantly wealthy, predominantly white communities. So they aren't actually even seeing the crimes that are happening in those communities. And it actually creates this kind of vicious cycle where they are going to places that historically have demonstrated greater arrest and therefore just continuing to feed that cycle.
Are there any rules anywhere that judges have to report when they've relied on AI to make these decisions?
That's a really good question, and I actually am not sure, so I can't really speak to that.
And what do, you know, going forward, is there any effort afoot to rein this in, to regulate it more, to learn more about how it's being used in an official way for governments?
Yeah, there's a national effort right now in Congress. There's a bill that was introduced called the Algorithmic Accountability Act, and it was sponsored by Congresswoman Yvette Clark. And currently, the legal scholars that I consulted say that this is probably one of the best pieces of proposed legislation right now to tackle this issue, not just for AI bias within criminal justice, but AI bias more broadly, mm-hmm. or bias in automated decision-making systems more broadly. And what it proposes is not to eliminate the use of it altogether, but to create what are called these impact assessments, where companies that are producing these systems in proprietary ways need to report basically metrics for evaluating whether or not it is perpetuating bias. So it needs to report how many, like Compass, for example, it would need to report how many people are being run through these systems, who is using these systems. It would need to report what the outcomes were, how often were their predictions correct, and split it based on race to see whether there are actually differences.
But how do you even groups. Study that? Because if it says don't let them out of jail and you don't, then how do you
right.
know
that? Right.
I hearken back to pre-crime and Minority Report.
Right. No, it's a really tough problem. The way that ProPublica sort of tried to address this problem when they were investigating the bias is because ultimately they were also using real defendant data of people that were jailed versus people that were released. And they actually looked at the 2-year period after someone was jailed and then released. Ultimately, when you're jailed, you get released at some point. So they looked at the 2-year period after that release date to see whether or not that person was essentially on good behavior. And if they were for that full 2-year period, it's like, well, you know,
must have worked.
They probably wouldn't have been arrested for a crime during their jail period.
Hmm. Are these programs expensive?
That's also a good question. There's no data that I know of that to answer that.
And then you created a game to go with your piece for MIT Technology Review, which we'll post on our website at wosu.org/allsides. But why did you do the game? What does the game do and why did you create it?
So one thing that we haven't touched on yet, which is even if you were to assume that your data is perfect, and what I mean is like there's no bias in the historical data and there's no discrepancy between crime and arrest, you still actually run into problems with algorithms being unfair or discriminatory towards Black defendants. And this isn't just for this particular example. It's also if you wanted to create a hiring algorithm and you were training the hiring algorithm like Amazon did at one point to figure out which candidates you want to hire versus dismiss. Any kind of automated decision system that is allocating resources or trying to make decisions in a certain way between different groups, you will run into these mathematically convoluted conflicts in different definitions of fairness. Because in society, we actually have different notions of fairness. I don't think people agree on one singular definition of fairness. Sometimes fairness means one thing in one context. Sometimes it means something in another. And when you actually go to mathematically quantify that in an algorithm, you can find that it's actually impossible to satisfy all of the different definitions of fairness at once. And so that's like a very complicated concept. And I wanted to use a game to really walk people step by step through that realization, essentially. Because it is really difficult to think about it from a theoretical perspective, but when you're playing the game, you're seeing the data visualized, you're like interacting with it to see how you can achieve different definitions of fairness, and hopefully by the end you'll realize that this is a really complicated problem and it's not always resolvable.
Karen Howell, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Karen Howe is an artificial intelligence reporter for MIT Technology Review. She recently wrote about how artificial intelligence is being used in the criminal justice system to make predictions about people who have been arrested. If you want to check that out and also check out the game she created to go with it, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides, and it will be right there. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
StoryCorps shares unscripted conversations between two people about important things in life: love, loss, family, friendship. StoryCorps partnered with WOSU Public Media to record and share the stories of our city. Recorded here, StoryCorps Columbus preserves pieces of our shared history for future generations. Subscribe to the StoryCorps Columbus podcast now at WOSU.org/StoryCorps, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from CAS, a division of the American Chemical Society. For over a century, CAS has been curating, developing, and delivering global scientific information solutions to enable discovery today and fuel tomorrow's innovation. Learn more at CAS.org.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Scientists have worked for decades to develop the so-called quantum computer. That's the heretofore theoretical machine that can perform in mere minutes calculations that would take thousands of years for the largest supercomputers in the world. Google last week announced that its own researchers had achieved that milestone. Scott Aronson is a theoretical computer scientist and director of the Quantum Information Center at the University of Texas at Austin. He saw Google's work on quantum computing prior to its publication. He also has given a couple TEDx talks about quantum computing, one at Caltech in 2011, and most recently in Dresden, Germany in 2017. He has also written about the topic for the New York Times. Welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. Great to be here.
The premise of quantum computing began in the 1980s. What sparked the inquiry into the in the first place?
Well, Richard Feynman was one of the first people to propose this idea, and what he noticed was that if you're trying to simulate quantum mechanics on a conventional computer. So, for example, because you want to simulate a chemical reaction or the behavior of some material, you know, but pretty much anything at the subatomic world, there's a really huge difficulty, and that is that the difficulty of doing the calculation on any of the computers that we have today seems to double with each particle that you add. So it seems to grow exponentially with the number of particles that you're trying to simulate. And the reasons for that go back to the heart of quantum mechanics, which has been, you know, the framework for almost all of physics since the 1920s. And what quantum mechanics says basically is that to every possible configuration of your system, you have to assign a number called an amplitude. Okay, so what that means is that if we had, let's say, 100 particles, and each one could be in one of two states, you know, representing one bit of information, well, then there are 2^100 power amplitudes that your computer would have to keep track of in order to simulate those particles, right? With 1,000, be 2^1,000, which is actually more than the number of atoms in the observable universe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Feynman's thought was basically, well, if nature is giving us this computational lemon, you know, making itself so hard to simulate on our computers, why don't we turn it into lemonade? You know, why don't we build computers that themselves would be based on the same principles? Now, as for what such a computer would be good for, Feynman really only knew one example, namely it would be good for simulating quantum physics itself. That's still probably the most important application that we know of for quantum computers. But in the 90s, computer scientists realized that quantum computers could even be used to provide huge speed-ups over anything that we know how to do with classical computers, even for certain purely classical problems. You know, and that's what really started the modern field of quantum computing and the attempt to realize it.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking with Scott Aronson. He's a theoretical computer scientist and director of the Quantum Information Center at the University of Texas at Austin about the announcement by Google last week that its researchers had achieved the milestone of a quantum computer. That's something that can perform in mere minutes, calculations that would take thousands of years for the largest supercomputers in the world. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So huge speeds, speed ups, it can do everything a lot faster. I'm just trying to wrap my brain.
Not everything.
Not everything. Well, yeah, that's a point. Okay.
Yeah.
What is the physical difference between a classical computer and a quantum computer?
Well, a classical computer is built out of bits, right? Just some physical elements that can be in two states that we label by zero and one. A quantum computer is built out of qubits, which are objects that can be in what we call superpositions of the zero and one states. So I was talking before about these amplitudes, right, these numbers that you have to assign to every way that a system could be. And these are really the central idea of quantum mechanics since it was formulated 90 years ago. And a qubit is just a bit that has some amplitude for being zero and some other amplitude for being one. So if you measure it, you sort of force it to randomly decide which you want it to be, and it collapses to one state or the other. But if you don't measure, then both amplitudes can contribute to the final result that you see. And if something can happen one way with a positive amplitude and another way with a negative amplitude, the two contributions can actually interfere and cancel each other out so that that thing doesn't happen at all. And, you know, with a quantum computer, you're really trying to exploit exactly that phenomenon of interference. So you're trying to get all of the contributions to the wrong answers to interfere destructively and cancel each other out, while the contributions to the right answer should reinforce each other.
IBM has been one of the skeptics of Google's claims. You read the paper before it was published.
Yes.
They argue that they could do it faster. How should mere mortals judge these claims?
Well, I mean, you know, it's actually a pretty simple dispute when you come down to it. I mean, Google did a calculation in 3 minutes with their device, where, you know, they estimated with the best currently known algorithm, which is actually an algorithm that a student and I published a few years ago, that it would have taken them about 10,000 years to do that on a classical supercomputer with a million parallel processors. Right, so that sounds like a very impressive speed up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one thing we know in computer science is you have to be very, very careful about numbers. Right, you know, we know much more about the scaling behavior than we know about the specific numbers. And now, what IBM said was, well, you know, Google was assuming a supercomputer with a fairly limited memory. But, you know, if you look at the largest supercomputer that currently exists on Earth, which is the Summit that IBM installed last year at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, this machine has 250 petabytes of hard disk. And they said that would be enough to take the entire list of amplitudes for Google's device, which means all 2 to the 53 power amplitudes, about 9 quadrillion of them, okay, and just store them all to hard disk. And then if they could just simulate the entire machine by brute force in about 2.5 days. Now, IBM hasn't actually done that. It's, you know, it's not so easy to get time on the world's largest supercomputer.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think it's plausible that something like that would work. And I don't know if it's exactly 2.5 days. Probably, you know, we wouldn't know until they tried it. But, you know, but something like that. So Google missed this. You know, on the other hand, you could say, well, if this is the strongest response, Well, you know, it's sort of like, you know, the Kasparov versus Deep Blue chess match, right? Except in an enormous irony with IBM now playing the role of Kasparov, right? It's like, you know, you can put forth a heroic effort to, you know, try to just barely maybe match what the quantum computer is doing, you know, again, for this very special calculation, right? But once Google upgrades, let's say, from 53 qubits, even to just 55 qubits, well, then now it would no longer fit in that 250 petabytes of memory that, you know, that the biggest supercomputer on Earth has, right? With 60 qubits, you would need 30 supercomputers this size. With 70 qubits, you would need enough of them to fill a city, right? The number is going to grow exponentially. So we're sort of now in this transitional period where supercomputers can maybe just barely keep up with quantum computer that's doing things, you know, maybe some thousands of times faster, and eventually, you know, and not just eventually, but soon, we expect that they won't be able to.
So, but you said how they can be used is still very limited.
Absolutely, that's right.
So, what are we doing it for?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think that it is of immense scientific value just to prove the point that, you know, it is possible to build a programmable quantum computer, you know, that does something faster, right? I mean, since, you know, quantum computing started to be seriously pursued in the 1990s, there have been many distinguished skeptics who have said, this is impossible. You are never going to control qubits well enough to do this. You know, they're just too fragile. And if quantum mechanics seems to say that it would work, well, then so maybe so much the worse for our present understanding of quantum mechanics. You know, this is an experiment that should give all of those skeptics pause. I mean, you know, I wouldn't want to be them right now, right? I'm not sure how they explain it. And what it is not a sufficient condition for doing anything useful with a quantum computer, but it is a necessary condition, right? Before you can do something that's faster and useful, you at least have to do something that is faster. Yeah. And now the race is going to be on to develop the useful application.
I really liked your description in something I read that compared it to the Wright brothers. I think I talked about it at the top of the hour that some I think it was you that likened it to their first plane flight in 1903 as proof of a possibility years before it could fulfill its potential.
That's right. I mean, they stayed aloft for 12 seconds, right? That was, you know, you wouldn't want to do passenger travel on the Wright flyer, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, its purpose was just to prove the point.
In your 2017 TEDx talk in Dresden, I believe, or correct me if I'm wrong, you said that this kind of quantum computing has wide economic applications. How so? What does economics have to do with it?
I think the most important economic application that we know of for quantum computers is still the original one that Feynman proposed in the 80s, and that is simulating quantum physics and chemistry themselves. So, I mean, anytime you want to design a new drug that, you know, binds to a receptor in a certain way, or you want to design a new material, like, you know, better batteries, better solar cells, better ways of making fertilizer, you know, you basically have a many-body quantum mechanics problem. And, you know, chemists and physicists have, you know, dealt with these problems for generations. They've developed all kinds of approximation methods and hacks that often work and, you know, that have often been rewarded with Nobel Prizes. But, you know, there are some many-body quantum mechanics problems that they still can't crack. And a quantum computer would just give you a general ability to just, you know, simulate, say, any chemical reaction, you know, without having to actually do it in the lab. And, you know, we don't know exactly what that will lead to, but that could be an enormous help in all of the different parts of science that you know, depend on you know, knowing the behavior of chemicals and materials when you have like lots of interacting electrons.
The issue of batteries, alone would change the course of history. You, some have said that Well, one of the issues or one of the concerns is the ability of quantum computers to be able to break high-level encryptions. There's a whole security piece to this. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, once the genie's out of the bottle, you know, I don't know what other kind of cliched reference I could make, but Pandora's box?
Okay. Well, you know, the discovery that sort of got everyone interested in quantum computing, you know, outside of the physics world in the 1990s was called Shor's algorithm, right? And this was an algorithm for quickly factoring huge numbers with a quantum computer. And why is that important? Well, because anytime you, you know, order something online or you see a padlock on your web browser or you see HTTPS, right, your credit card number is being protected by some encryption system whose security depends on the belief that factoring is a hard problem, or that, you know, a few other problems are hard that, as it turns out, quantum computers could also solve. Okay, so basically the current way that we protect our data on the internet could be broken. Now, it's important to realize that, you know, that number one, not with the quantum computers that we're going to have soon, right? Google's device was 53 qubits. And before you could start threatening cryptography, we think you're going to need something called quantum error correction. And to get quantum error correction, you need maybe thousands of physical qubits to encode each logical qubit. And so then by that point, you might be talking about millions of physical qubits. And I don't think anyone is even close to that. But yeah, that could eventually happen. And some people, you know, who want to keep their data secure for the next 20 years, let's say, are already worried about that. But now the other thing to understand is that there are other methods of encryption that we don't think that even a quantum computer would be able to break. Okay, and so there's already some push to migrate to those new methods of encryption. And so, you know, there would be countermeasures to take where we could, you know, maintain a secure internet. We just have to, you know, start the process of migrating to that.
You know, I read that China has spent $400 million in quantum research, and I don't think that doesn't sound like a lot of money to me, because I guess I'm just getting completely warped by our federal deficit and whatnot. But
it's a lot by our standards.
It's still a lot. I mean, is all of this research expensive to do?
Well, to hire a theorist like me, right?
You know, I
just need a, you know, a blackboard, some coffee, right? You know, a laptop, right?
Right.
But, you know, the experiments, I mean, I mean, today, you know, to have a state of the art quantum computing lab like the kind that Google or IBM has is probably $100 million outlay at the least, right? So it's actually, by the standards of the computer industry in general, these are still tiny amounts of money, right? You know, by the standards of Google or Microsoft, right? This is not a whole lot, which is, you know, maybe, you know, and indeed these companies have, you know, made those kind of investments in quantum computing. By the standards of academia, that's enormous, right? And it's past the point where, say, you know, a university can really compete with the Googles or the IBMs in terms of scaling things up.
Is there an ethical piece to any of this?
Well, I think that there's always an ethical piece to science. I mean, you try to do something that is good for the world, you know. Fortunately, I don't think a quantum computer will, you know, at least directly kill anyone. It's not like a nuclear weapon, right? I mean, yeah, it could compromise internet security. But as I said, there are countermeasures to that. And, you know, I think ultimately, you know, the effect on science and the effect on the world from having this general ability to simulate nature at the molecular level would be a good one.
Scott Aronson, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate
it.
Scott Aronson is a theoretical computer scientist and director of the Quantum Information Center at the University of Texas at Austin. We have been talking about the news from Google that they have achieved the milestone of a theoretical, or what has been theoretical in the past, of a quantum computer. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Connected home devices aren't just for security and music. They can also be programmed to automate Halloween atmosphere. Joining us, Android Central contributing editor, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So I don't need that bowl with that battery-operated talking head anymore. I can just get my home devices to do the work for me.
There's a lot of different options that you have here. It's actually my favorite thing to do with smart home things, regardless of what time of year it is to mess with the other people in my house. It's probably the reason that I spent so much money on them. But definitely for Halloween, you can mess with other people, not just the people that live with you and can seek revenge. The best thing that I have found, especially if you have kind of simple color-changing bulbs and maybe a smart doorbell, is you can actually set the doorbell to change colors on the light. So one of the, like a really clever kind of simple thing, if you already have the hardware, is to just program your doorbell to tell the lights to change colors, maybe to a dark red or to a kind of, you know, ghostly green or something when the doorbell gets pushed. And then you can set that during Halloween. So there's no actual people around, but someone comes up and presses the doorbell and then immediately the front porch light has turned red. And maybe you can, you know, if you have a smart outlet, you can also set a fog machine to turn on at the same time. And then it all just, you know, kind of revolves around how this technology can talk to one another.
You can trigger a scream when someone hits the doorbell?
You can, yeah. One of the cool things, you can set a Spotify.
That gets you way too happy, excited.
It's great. It's so much fun. You can set Spotify to different playlists that are, you know, kind of scary sounds and things like that that are all a part of Spotify. And then you can actually set that to play automatically based on a motion sensor being tripped or a button being pressed. Logitech, for example, makes these really simple, kind of pop buttons that you can put underneath of things so that if someone steps on your doormat, it pushes the button, and that would make the Spotify playlist start playing, and then you just have a speaker nearby that is set to as loud or as quiet as you want, depending on how you want to mess with people as they come up to your house.
Do you tell me what's the basic equipment you need? I mean, if you don't have a smart doorbell and that kind of a thing, or a smart front door light, what can you do without that kind of stuff?
Sure. So, I mean, you know, if you want to get this done really quickly and using just kind of equipment that you can get from your local electronics store, $15 or $20 will get you a smart outlet, which is just a thing that plugs into your existing outlet and gives you the ability to kind of remotely turn it on and off. And you can connect that to strobe lights or to fog machines or anything that you would normally have set up. And then you can connect that to, you know, basically anything. You can even have it set to your phone, just when you push a button. If you have an Amazon Echo or a Google Home in your house, you can easily use one of those to set this up as well.
Do you need to be Russell Holly to be able to do all this, or do you think Ann Fisher could pull it off
so
if she had to?
There's a lot of really easy tools that are built into this stuff, especially when it comes to the Amazon Echo system and the Google Play system. There are systems called Routine. It's right in the application. There's a great big button that says routines, and you just tell it what you want to do under various circumstances. So you can have it set so that for actual home privacy features, not just for, you know, scaring kids on Halloween, you can set it to turn random lights in your house on and off to give the illusion that you're home.
Okay.
When you're not away. Like there are a lot of things that you can use these routine sets for. But especially on Halloween, you can use them to just mess with everyone.
Well, we'll post a link to Russell's well-researched article about how to use connected home devices to scare people on your front porch. So just stand by. That's at WOSU.org/allsides. We were just talking about Google and quantum physics, and I thought my head was going to explode, but there's something a little more down to earth. Google's planning to buy Fitbit?
Yeah, there was actually a big part of the announcement yesterday, right ahead of its earnings report, was Google teased a plan to try and make a bid for Fitbit. And really what this comes down to is Google has decided that it really needs to ramp up its competition for the Apple Watch.
Uh-huh.
The only game in town right now when it comes to, you know, company that competes with Apple when it comes to especially fitness trackers is Fitbit. Like it's pretty much, if you go to an electronics store and you look for something that you want to wear on your wrist, it's either Fitbit or Apple right now.
But I thought Google had a watch.
Google has worked with several different companies to make things that are running its own operating system, that, you know, like Fossil, for example. Something that runs Android on it. But those are definitely made by those companies, those are managed by those companies and maintained by those companies. Google has always had, like its Pixel phones, a desire to have kind of a reference to kind of guide the rest of the industry, what it thinks is best. And it just hasn't had a tremendous amount of success doing that, working with these existing partners.
And what was the response to its bid?
There's not been a lot of public response to it so far from Fitbit itself, but the general response from the people who own Fitbits and people who are excited about Google competing with Apple have been remarkably positive.
Oh.
And a lot of this comes down to, you know, Google has to be able to compete with Apple in some really key places. And one of those places is kind of the health and fitness tracking. You know, when you take a look at the Apple Watch as a functional device, one of the really fascinating set of stories that come from it are people who have actually had their lives saved by wearing an Apple Watch. You know, and that's not an exaggeration. You know, the heart rate detection includes, you know, irregularity detection and monitoring, and has instructed older people to go and get checked out by an actual doctor if irregularities have been detected. And a fall monitor that actually recently saved a mountain climber who fell off the sheer side of a mountain. And the impact triggered the Apple Watch's emergency response, which let, you know, first responders know that there was trouble on the mountain that they needed to address.
Would it have the same effect if I fall down a flight of stairs?
Yes, it absolutely
would.
Good
to know. Okay. In case someone pushes me. All right. And by the way, just curious, what are they offering? Do we know?
We don't know exactly what they're offering yet. I suspect that that's something we'll end up finding in the next week. But it's really fascinating that they're being very public about this, that they, you know, that this kind of thing is happening now, especially, Google's had definitely a good year financially, but it's clear that moving into hardware is something that Google knows that it needs to do in order to continue to compete with Apple, who is at the same time starting to move into services like the Apple TV Plus service.
I was kind of surprised when you said this, because I was surprised that Fitbit was still a company to be bought. I would have thought it would have been bought up by now.
One of the really fascinating things about Fitbit is that it's actually been the company doing the buying over the last couple of years. There have been a lot of competition like Misfit and several others that Fitbit has actually acquired in order to strengthen its own portfolio over the last couple of years.
We should talk about NVIDIA Shield TV. You recommend it. You said it's the best Android TV box, according to the Android Central reviews. How so?
This is really cool. So one of the really fascinating things about a lot of streaming boxes and sticks and things like that is that what they do is they make it so that you plug it directly into the back of the television and it kind of hangs off the back of it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the designs for that, they end up being called dongles that you know, hang off the back of your television. And one of the really fascinating things about that design is it's actually kind of not good for streaming video, because your television is this big, bulky electronic thing that actually impedes wireless reception. So your connection to streaming services actually lessens by having this thing behind your television, unless your router is also behind your television. One of the really clever things that NVIDIA did to address this was actually make their streaming device a cylinder that doesn't have any lights or any buttons or anything on it that you tuck away under the television or beside the television in such a way that it's not seen. So it doesn't hang off the back of the television. It can kind of hide away in a place that's easier to receive that wireless signal. And as a result, has some really clever, technology to improve its wireless capability. So it's able to get a more true-to-life, HDR image and 4K image. And on top of that, uses this really clever bit of artificial intelligence to upscale things that are not 4K if you're using a 4K television. So things that are recorded in 1080, for example, all of Disney's videos that you can stream online are none of them are in 4K. They're all in 1080. So if you were to watch them on this thing, it actually uses some really clever software to make it look as though it is 4K and actually improve on the image quality.
Is this the X1 Plus processor?
The processor that's involved in this. It takes every single frame and analyzes it for a brief second and sees where it can apply some artificially enhanced sharpening textures to just make all of the things happening in the foreground look more realistic and true to life.
Any downside to this?
So the inherent downside, aside from its price, is $150, which when you compare to an Amazon Fire TV stick or something like that, is definitely on the spendy side. Mm-hmm. But the only real downside to this artificial intelligence system is that it is not something you have a ton of control over. So if you are watching something that is, 60 frames per second instead of 30 frames per second, then it doesn't work. It only works in very specific environments.
Okay. Apple TV Plus is coming out November 1st. You say it looks good. What's good about it?
Yeah, so Apple's big push here is to try and get as many, kind of unique and original television shows, as possible to the foreground so that over the next year they can convince people that the service is worth continuing to pay for. Anyone who bought an iPhone or an Apple TV or something this year gets that first year for free. And so after that year, Apple's gonna really hope that people are gonna be willing to pay that, between $8 and $10 a month, depending on what service you want, for this content. And what they're doing is they're starting out with some really compelling shows, including this really fascinating series called C, starring Jason Momoa, about a civilization where everyone is entirely blind. And it's just really cool. If you've seen the trailer for it,
I have, and I would really, really like to see that show. Can I come over?
Yeah, because
I don't have Apple TV.
Let's have a viewing party. It'd be great. There's one thing I'm not shy about doing, it's staring at Jason Momoa. So.
Exactly. And all right, so those new shows, but where's the tipping point going to be? Because those things aren't cheap. That guy's not cheap.
Right, yeah. I mean, and that's the big thing about all of these shows is Apple has poured a ton of money into really big names. There's a comedy series with Steven Carell coming out.
Right.
There's just a lot of things that are hitting this with a lot of big names. I think if I remember correctly, Oprah is doing a limited series through it as well. Like Apple has poured a ton of cash into this. And on top of that, there's a lot of people who bought an iPhone this year that are not going to be paying for that first year of service.
Uh-huh.
So I think that it's a lot of money that Apple is spending up front and in hoping that this works. And it's really just going to depend on how popular these shows end up being.
So it's anyone who's bought an Apple thingy this past year.
Yeah, if you got an Apple TV or if you got a new iPad or if you got a new iPhone over the last couple months, then if you bought it in an Apple store, they are not shy about telling you, hey, by the way, on November 1st, you get Apple TV. It's just going to start working for you. But everyone else, they're going to be asked to pay this, I think it's $7 a month for that starting service.
So I should ask for an iPad for Christmas.
You should ask for an iPad for
okay,
Christmas,
finally.
Specifically so you can watch more Jason Momoa with me. We could do it together.
I know we could do it. Okay. Surface Go Kids Bundle, it includes, tell us what it is, first of all. Surface Go and what's the Kids Bundle?
Sure. So the Surface Go is actually my favorite version of the Surface from Microsoft. It's not particularly powerful, but it's extremely portable. It's actually my favorite thing. I can travel 3,000 miles and do my entire job from my girlfriend's bed. And not have to worry about, not having enough power for browser tabs or anything like that. It's my favorite thing that Microsoft makes. And it's also only like $300 or $400, depending on which model you get. And they're trying to make it more kid-friendly. So what they're doing is they're selling this bundle. It's $50 more than what you would normally spend on it, but you're getting a really durable case around it and some clever accessories, including some headphones. Really to kind of sell this whole your kid doesn't need an iPad thing.
Okay.
you can take this and they can use it in the car and they have access to all of the same basic features that you would get on an iPad. Plus it looks more durable, it comes with these headphones. So that's what Microsoft is trying to do here is they've already sold people like me. They're really hoping that they can encourage parents to kind of share this experience with children as well.
And I'm just curious, the battery life.
The battery life on this, it usually gets me about 6 hours of constant use for me, which is probably a little more aggressive than what a kid would be doing. It's probably watching a lot of Netflix and maybe drawing.
Yeah.
So I would definitely say that for a kid, it would be pretty comparable to what you would get with one of the mid-range iPads, but probably not as good as some of the bigger iPads that have much larger batteries.
And then the gumdrop foam tech case, is that like a jelly type case?
It does have kind of a jelly-type feel to it. It's got a texture on the back, so it's a lot easier to grip.
Oh, okay.
And like the headphones, also comes in this really neat kind of purple with teal accents that I thought was really
cool. They've got your number. I'm telling you, Russell.
I'm telling you, people like you, the weight of my heart is bright colors. That's true.
Especially purple. Russell Holly, thank you so much, as always. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holley, contributing editor for Android Central. He joins us every week on Tech Tuesday, just like you. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.